Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Futures in Biotech is provided by CashFly at CashFly.com.
This is Mark Peltier with Futures in Biotech, Episode 8, for Wednesday, November 8, 2006. In this episode, Leo Laporte and I discuss the emerging field of synthetic biology with our guest, Dr. Drew Andy. He's the Cabot Assistant Professor of Biological Engineering at MIT. Now, I would like to quote Dr. Andy, and this is taken from a lecture from MIT World, and I'll provide the link to this in our show notes at www.twit.tv/fib and futuresinbiotech.blogspot.com. It really outlines well the topic of their discussion today. He says, and I quote, "We are going from looking at the living world as only coming from nature to a subset of the living world being produced by engineers who design and build hopefully useful living artifacts according to our specifications. This means that we are at the dawn of a transition. Not only will molecular biologists continue to dissect the genome, but the parts, or genes, will be used to engineer novel organisms for desired purpose or novel use. Synthetic biology is to genetic engineering what Web 2.0 is to the internet. This is truly biotech of the 21st century." Welcome, Dr. Andy.
Hello.
I think one of the... So you're an engineer, and one of the biggest questions, the first questions I have is, how does an engineer see a living organism?
A living organism is a reproducing machine, a machine that can make a copy of itself, that can make a lot of other things as well, right? So it's an object that lets you do stuff.
So it's really interesting to have this completely different perspective on this than all the biologists we've been talking to.
Yeah, I don't know, how else to look at the things. I mean, it's sort of like if you were a computer programmer, you'd look at a computer not as this thing to, you know, sequence its genome and tear it all apart and scatter the pieces about the lawn, but you'd think of it as this object that you would try and program, right? And in some respects, a living organism is an equivalent object, except it has some additional features, like it can copy itself. So any computer scientist I've met who understands what biology is thinks biology is incredibly cool, not as a science, although that's true, but it's incredibly cool as a programming substrate, you know, a place where you can program stuff.
Do you think that you have to see it more holistically than a biologist does?
No, not necessarily. I think that it just happens to be the case that when you're tearing something apart, as biologists sometimes do, you often get sucked down into the nitty-gritty of what might be a little widget, you know, and you just have to focus on it at that level.
You see it as a system.
Depends on what level we're working, right? I mean, one of the tools of an engineer is to use... something called abstraction, where you can organize the functioning of a system across levels of power, basically. So you could be down in the weeds at a very fine detail, you know, thinking about the A's, the T's, the C's, the G's that make up the low-level machine language of a cell. But at a totally different time, you might be operating up at the level of an integrated system, as you were saying, you know, where this thing's sensing some information in the environment, implementing some logic and memory, activating some actuators to cause something to happen. And the art, part of the art of engineering is be able to transition in a principled way across these different levels of function without getting lost in all of the complexity, the apparent complexity of the biology.
So you don't necessarily need to or expect to understand all the genes' functions to be able to engineer an organ.
Well, we don't. I mean,
so you're sort of transitioning.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of, I don't know if we want to jump right into this, but what the heck, right? I mean, engineers never have a perfect understanding of the substrate or object that they're engineering, right? And the art of engineering is nevertheless being able to deliver a reliable system in the face of those constraints, plus other constraints like a budget and, you know, a limited ability to interact with the physical world. So if you look at the Golden Gate Bridge, right, that's an object that structural engineers are able to put together even in absence of a perfect understanding of gravity, you know, thanks to work ongoing in physics, right? So we're able to engineer physical systems in the absence of perfect understanding. We have to be able to do that.
Do you have, are you guys working on some examples right now? And this is a field you refer to as synthetic biology. Maybe you could give us a little definition of what synthetic biology is.
So a couple different ways to come at it, right? So synthetic biology is a form of engineering involving biology where the goal is basically to develop a framework such that we could program living organisms to do our bidding in a way that is cheap, fast, and reliable. So it is basically second-generation genetic engineering, if you want to think of it that way. But if you look at the process of genetic engineering as it's played out over the last 30 years, while it's been hugely successful, it's still very much an artisanal research business, where if you were to try and design and build, as it were, a particular engineered biological system, you wouldn't know what the probability of success would be on the day you set out. You wouldn't know how long it would take, and you wouldn't know how much it would cost if it was successful. And
it's definitely a huge investment in trial and error.
So the goal of synthetic biology is to basically make the engineering of biology routine, reliable, to de-skill the process such that it happens in garages, that you have garage biotechnology. And, you know, the sophistication of the things that we could produce become much greater as a result.
Would you see yourself more as a coder or an engineer? You know,
I don't know.
At what level do you do the engineering? Can you integrate multiple levels of engineering, or do you expect synthetic biology to be strictly DNA?
No, that's a great question. At the moment, we've got four different levels of engineering, as it were, and that's not a lot. It is a lot for biology, but it's not a lot for engineering. If you go into computer science, for example, they might have a dozen levels in what'll be called a hierarchy of abstraction, or basically different types of function. I'm sorry if that gets a little esoteric, but basically in synthetic biology, we've got the lowest level, which is the DNA, you know, the A's, T's, C's, and G's. And if, I mean, the next level up is going to be this, everything else is just, we make it up, right? So the next level up is called parts, which is sort of purposely boring,
parts.
Right? It's like parts. So parts are human-defined objects. They are bits of genetic material, DNA, that carry out functions inside cells, right? So an example would be a function that causes the cell to change its color from green to red, or from black to green, or something like that. And so you could have a world where you have to memorize the sequence of DNA, A, T, G, G, T, A, C, T, C, right, that goes on for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of letters that programs a cell to turn green. And that would suck, basically. I mean, that'd just be a tremendous amount of work. And so instead of memorizing all of those little letters, we go, well, we're just going to call this thing a part. And this part's going to turn the cell green. And we're going to give the part a number. We're going to call it C0083. And so if I want a part that makes the cell turn green, I don't memorize the sequence of DNA. I just look up the number C0083 and I get it out of a catalog. Which in
like,
this day,
it's like a programming macro.
Absolutely,
I was waiting for Leo to come in on that because I was thinking a script or I don't know a line.
It's actually more primitive than that. It's a basic function that would make up a programming language, you know. So it would be like
primitive.
Yes, exactly right. So it would be like a print statement. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
If you're programming in Python or something like that.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of work, but it's all encapsulated in that one word.
Right. So you know, like somebody has to invent the programming languages, basically. And at the moment, we don't have languages or grammars that support programming in DNA. And so the transition from the DNA level, the lowest level, to the second level of parts is the beginnings of an invention, basically, of a programming language. And just to put it out there, maybe we come back to it. Once you get to parts, then you immediately start putting parts together to make more powerful objects. We get to make this up. We call them devices. And then once you have devices, you get to make still more powerful objects. Again, we're just making this up. We call it systems, right? So the DNA will be at the bottom. The parts will be the basic functions. A device might be something that implements Boolean logic, like an AND or an OR gate. You know, takes in a couple inputs and processes them and makes an output signal. And then a system might be something like a whole bacterial cell that's programmed to sense stuff in its environment, process that information, and decide whether or not it found a tumor cell and wants to invade the tumor cell, right? And so we've got the DNA level, we've got the parts level, the device level, and the systems level. And if you're an engineer now working in biology, you could choose to specialize and say, I'm going to be a badass systems engineer, or I'm going to be really, really good at manipulating DNA with toothpicks and the low-level bit code and stuff like that. And I'm going to choose to specialize.
Let me take a little step back here, because this is, there's no question, an era of transition. But if you look at our current state, right, with HIV, which has, you know, only 9 genes and kills tens of millions of people, has killed tens of millions of people, we can't tackle it, right? Or cystic fibrosis, if you break it down to just 3 single bases of DNA, you know, in the CF gene, it's a death sentence at roughly 34, right? How are you going to... it's really early to be thinking synthetic biology where you've got a parts list and you can sort of build an entire organism if right now the technology is at a point where, you know, we can't fix 3 bases in a human being.
Well, you're trying to trick me in a way you're bringing up a totally different area of research,
right?
So why is it so hard to figure out what the heck's going on with HIV and how we could stop it? Right. Which is an incredibly important problem to be working on. Or how come we can't figure out how natural biological systems work, basically, is what you're saying.
I could transition this. Do you see synthetic biology coming in and sort of as engineers might fix a bridge? Do you think synthetic biology could be used to replace not only genes, but perhaps whole pathways of genes?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Right. So let me, I'm happy to answer your question. I just need to be careful in recognizing that you're actually raising a different question entirely, right? So the purpose of synthetic biology is to make it easier to design and build new or synthetic living organisms that behave as expected. The question you just asked was sort of the form, well, we've got these things we find in nature, some of which we care deeply about because they're hurting people, and we'd like to stop them or we'd like to change them. But when we do it, we find out that it's really hard. And it's important to think about why those are two different problems. So to look at HIV, for example, it's complicated for a number of reasons, ranging from the basics of its genetics to all of the fact that it infects a very complicated organism, people, right? So if you want to understand HIV, you actually also have to understand the host that parasite's infecting, the human being. But there's a more subtle reason, which I think touches on the distinction between the science of biology as it's mostly practiced today and where synthetic biology is going. Natural biological systems, so far as we can tell, are not themselves designed to be easy for human beings to understand and interact with. You know, where's the instruction manual for HIV? The documentation in the source code? The maintenance kit? Or for a person, for that matter? You know, like really intelligent design would have documentation. Would be one way to say it. And if you look at natural biological systems, right, they're produced, so far as we can tell, via this process of evolution, which is trial and error and selection. And evolution at the level of the architecture inside the systems is really messy, it looks like. So imagine if I was trying to fix a television, right, and instead of the television being produced by General Electric or Panasonic or whatever, the television was found underneath a tree. It had fallen off the television tree. And televisions had been evolved for 3 billion years. And gosh, we had this real important problem with TVs that we needed to fix. But we couldn't figure out how to reverse engineer televisions because, nobody understood how they work. We didn't know what all the parts were. They hadn't been designed by a human being to begin with to be easy to understand. Some people thought they were magical. What a mess. And so I can give you lots of reasons why HIV is hard to figure out. It's infecting a complicated organism and so on and so forth. But also, it wasn't designed to be easy to figure out. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So you're saying that what you're doing is not reverse engineering, which would be what we would try to do to figure out that TV, but you're starting from scratch and building organisms.
Yeah, forward engineering.
Forward engineering.
Now,
which is a lot saner process.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in other words, you know, construction is simpler than analysis sometimes, right?
Right.
Is the underlying hypothesis. Now we have to demonstrate practically, right, that that's true.
Well, you also gain insight. It'll certainly help you reverse engineer. In fact,
yeah.
you couldn't. I mean, to extend the analogy to tech to software, you couldn't really be a very good at reverse engineering software if you hadn't written quite a bit in the first place.
That's exactly right. So sort of like imagine trying to two things to say. So imagine trying to learn a language if all you could do was read. You could go to the library and you could read poetry, say, and things that other people had written. But you had no capability for composing and writing your own prose. I suppose you could learn a language by such a process, but I bet it would be kind of hard relative to, say, if you went to a totally different planet where you could go to a library and read what other people had written, but you also were given a pen and paper and a word processor, and you were encouraged to write your own stuff. And so you're absolutely right that by trying to construct stuff from scratch, the worst case scenario is we won't be able to actually make anything that we hope to be able to make, but we'll fail over and over again. And since biological systems are physical objects, we'll be failing for actual physical reasons that we can then go study. So the worst case scenario for synthetic biology is we can't actually deliver anything useful that anybody cares about because we don't understand biology well enough. Thus, we'll have to go help with the science.
Well, that time is going to come. I mean, there's no question with the speed of, you know, gene profiling that's going on, characterized function of genes and you know, large scale proteomic studies and interactome studies, you know, things we've covered a little bit in the show. We're going to have that understanding to a point where you're going to be able to, you know, not only create an organism in, using forward engineering that does a specific task or, you know, or is under control, but I think you're going to be able to start, you know, using some of those engineering processes to go back and fix, you know, what ails the human body, right? Genetic disease, or maybe create a superhuman or a super immune system. I mean, we're talking maybe 100 years from now.
No, I think it's much shorter than that. Much sooner.
Really?
Really?
Yeah.
You got us interested there, boy.
Well, I mean, So
it's scary. It's kind of scary because, you know, it raises. We're going to talk maybe.
About... Oh, I'm not scared. No. I want to ask him. So what are you building now? How does this work? Are these software only? Are they actual physical entities?
Well,
I'm not worried about Frankenstein at this point.
Yeah. Well, so when you think about genetic engineering,
that's Dr. Griffith's work.
Yeah. When you think about genetic engineering, what do you imagine? Like, what comes to your mind? What's going on? Is it, you know, people working in a lab with vats of colored liquid bubbling and smoke every now and then?
Yeah.
So that's. That's the past, is the simplest way to say it.
That's how we used to do it. Is that what you're saying?
Right. So that all still happens. So synthetic biology is not only, I mean, it is a combination of words, and there's a lot of discussion about what those words mean, but there's some actual technology which underlies it, which is changing the process by which people approach the challenges of engineering biological systems. So one of the things we've talked about already in sort of an ad hoc fashion is this idea of abstraction. You know, but that's an abstract idea. There are simpler technologies which are much more as powerful, right? So one of them that's very interesting is called DNA synthesis, or just synthesis for short. So DNA synthesis is an interesting technology. Basically, have you guys heard about that? Perchance,
I've used it to engineer some genes to create, you know, some.
So, describe what it is. What is DNA?
Okay, so DNA synthesis is you have a machine. It's called a DNA synthesizer, and you give the machine two things. You give it raw chemicals, which are derived from sugarcane, okay, and then you give it information, which comes from a computer, okay. And the information is a string of letters, the bases of DNA, A, T, C, or G, and the DNA synthesizer takes the string of information, and that string of information programs the synthesizer to make a physical piece of DNA from scratch. Right? So if you watch Star Trek, and they've got the food replicators in the walls of the ship, you know, where they say, I'd like a mocha, you know, a pumpkin spice mocha or whatever,
yeah.
Whatever Starbucks selling this time of year.
Klingon food or whatever.
Yeah, right. So and it sort of compiles the food from thin air, right, from information and atoms from somewhere. They never really tell you where the atoms are coming from, although I'm sure somebody knows where the atoms come from. DNA synthesis is a matter compiler for genetic material. So that should sound important. I don't know how to make that sound more important, but basically we have machines called DNA synthesizers, which are matter compilers for genetic material. And genetic material is DNA, which, oh, by the way, is the stuff that runs all living organisms we care about. Right? So we have matter compilers for the stuff that programs living organisms. So what this means is, to go back to the question is, if I want to be a genetic engineer in the future, what I want is I want a laptop computer. And I want a laptop computer that's hooked up to databases of objects, let's call them parts, that get me the sequence of DNA that programs cells to do stuff. And then I want to have a programming environment that lets me mix and match these functions to compile a big piece of DNA that I then ship out to a DNA synthesis company to make the DNA. And then the DNA synthesis company ships the DNA via overnight delivery either back to me in my lab or to somebody else's lab who I pay to do the experiments for me.
You're almost describing a chip fab, except instead of a chip, you're making a...
And that's not a coincidence, right? So a couple years ago, we went and spoke with Lynn Conway, who worked with Carver Mead back in the mid to late 1970s to implement VLSI electronics, right? And one of the innovations that Lynn pulled off was something called the multi-project chip, where prior to her work, it was the case that if you wanted to get a piece of silicon fabbed with some design on it, you more or less had to know somebody in one of the fab facilities, and they had these like fancy rules you had to follow and blah, 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 blah. What a pain in the butt. So Lynn and Carver, pulled off this hack where they simplified the interface between the design and the construction of a piece of silicon in terms of integrated electronics, such that students basically could do their design work. They did the work at MIT, it turns out, and then they emailed their designs to a fab and had the chips designed. It was called this multi-project chip. And because they put multiple student projects on the same chip, they could afford to do it. And it was this, as a result, you had this decoupling, this separation of design work from the construction work. So today, right, if you come visit Cambridge and MIT and Harvard and what have you, and you walk around the biology labs, you see that many of the people spend a lot of time, like 50% of their time, just bashing DNA, manipulating DNA with artisanal technology, restriction enzymes and this, that, the other thing.
Yes, and I'll attest to that.
It's just a tremendous amount of work. It's sort of like programming a computer by pushing zeros and ones around, right, with toothpicks.
Punch cards. It's punch cards. It's a little bit worse than punch cards.
Yeah, that's right. It actually is because you can't see them, right? You can't see the DNA. The punch cards, at least, are these macroscopic objects, right, that are the size of punch cards, whereas the pieces of DNA are invisible and they're tiny and you, like, accidentally, evaporate them or do something with them, then your whole week's worth of work goes away. So imagine now that instead of having that, you have a laptop computer, you have wireless, and you're doing your design work on a computer-aided design suite, and you drop ship your information over the net to a fab, which builds your DNA for you. So that's the importance of synthesis from an engineer's perspective is more or less unbounded. It's an essential technology for us because it lets us begin to do the iterations, the many rounds of trial and error to figure out how to invent these new programming languages for DNA.
Well, let me ask you, because the technology as is, there's a reason why people are using restriction enzymes and maybe some PCR to amplify genes and stuff.
Yeah.
It's because there's cost limitations. There's, sort of the... I suppose cost limitations is the biggest one, and the size limitations of what's generally available in terms of genetic material. Synthesizing a gene, you might be able to get away with making short segments, and then you anneal them together and piece by piece.
Yeah.
Where do you see DNA synthesizers going over the next 5-10 years?
That's a good question. I don't know. Who can say what the future is like, right? But I mean, I can tell you what's happened over the last 5 years. Right,
you've started a company, right?
Yeah,
must have a 5-year projection of where. So the company's called Codon?
Codon.
Founded?
Yeah, Codon. But that's. Happy to talk about that, but let's start by looking at what's happened over the last 5 years, right?
Sure.
So when I moved from Berkeley to Massachusetts, synthesizing a gene might be 1,000 letters long, right? That cost about $10 to $16 a letter, right? So if you wanted to buy a gene that was 1,000 letters, that would cost you $10,000 or 10 kilobucks, right?
A 1K, 1K is...
A 1,000 base pair gene would cost you $10,000.
$10,000 right? for 1K. This, right. Now, Leo, you might see a parallel here.
So,
yeah, no kidding.
Cost of synthesizing a gene has dropped by a factor of 2 each of the last 5 years. Okay? So it's now about 79 cents a base pair. So, okay, that's pretty cool. Now, what's even more cool about it is once I have the gene synthesized, it's a piece of DNA, and DNA is really good if you put it in the right cell at making copies of itself for free, basically. So once I get the gene synthesized once, I can make more copies of it for approximately no money and give it to everybody else for free. So where's synthesis likely to go? Well, if the cost is 70 or 80 cents a base pair now, I bet it'll be 40 cents a base pair in a year, and 20 cents a base pair in 2 years, and 10 cents a base pair in 3 years, which means that building a gene is now $100. And at some point, the price of, you know, building a gene should be pennies a base pair. All of the low-level technologies for doing this exist today. What's never been done is the integration of all of the technologies in some industrial-scale process that results in the efficiencies of scale and speed, basically, as well as the reliability. So a company like Codon represents a capital investment, not in novel chemistry or this, that, or the other thing, but how to bring everything together, how to bring the engineering expertise to build the fab. In the same way that, you know, 100 years ago, there did not exist facilities that were capable of making very pure, impressive wafers of silicon. And you can just look at how good those technologies have gotten. So I think it would be foolish to imagine a future where 5 to 10 years from now, building genes from scratch isn't approximately noise in a laboratory's budget, meaning it's more or less not a big expense, and that building much longer things is a routine process. If you go back, if we were doing the show in 1990. You know, we would be having discussions about whether or not it would be possible to sequence genomes, read out genomes with sequencing. Which, you know, sequencing is a technology that lets you take a piece of DNA and read it out. You know, we hadn't in 1990, if I remember right, we'd never even read out the genome of a lowly bacteria, right? But if you go 10 years into the future, and by 2000, we have a draft sequence of the human genome, right? So somehow, in a period of 10 years, we went from arguing about whether or not it was possible to sequence bacteria's genomes to, well, we've done lots of bacteria, we've done some other things like the worm and what have you, if I remember right. I can't remember when the worm came online. And then we've done the person. Right, so where are we today with synthesis? Well, you know, a bunch of virus genomes have been synthesized. People are working now on synthesizing bacterial genomes. And if folks have their act together, that should be done before the end of 2007, which means that on a time scale of 10 years, I think we're going to have the technology in place to construct human genomes from scratch.
So you foresee the assembly of entire chromosomes?
The technology will... Absolutely. The technology. I mean, there's already projects that have been proposed, if not underway, to rebuild Baker's yeast, Saccharomyces cerevisiae, which is 12 million base pairs. At today's prices, that would be an $8 million project, right?
Which is by no means out of touch. I mean, there are genomics projects that cost a lot more than that.
That's right. It's a lot of money, but it's not an infinite amount of money.
No,
right?
Definitely not.
What's the length of the human genome? 3 to 4 billion base pairs, right? So the cost of synthesizing that would be, you know, $2 to $3 billion. Note that there are individuals on the planet today with that much, you know, net worth. So it's not that our synthesizers exist that you could push the button and out would pop a human genome. But I think it would be short-sighted to imagine that the technology won't be developed on a timescale that results in that being possible, if not accessible, to many folks within a decade.
Well, here's that segue into the ethical issues. You know, I could see, you know, this, if you could reconstruct a chromosome or get entire set of chromosomes, you could start designing humans or offspring, right, for people that have genetic disease. this is reality. If what you're saying is going to happen, I certainly believe it will. What kind of legal issues are you going to have to sort of balance out not only, you know, the parts list, what you can use as parts and copyrights and other issues like that, but how do we protect, you know, the integrity of the human genome, or should we?
Oh, I think we absolutely have to. I think we have to have some conversations that are society-wide, which are focused on the question of if and how do we become comfortable accepting responsibility for the direct, you know, human-directed manipulation of genetic information. Now, we've had those conversations for the last 30 years, but they've been conversations at a point in time where the technology that lets you do the work is extraordinarily primitive, right? And with synthesis technology and the parts and abstraction all coming online, these new technologies are each as important as recombinant DNA was, as polymerase chain reaction was, as DNA sequencing was. I mean, these technologies are as important as those three foundational technologies of biotech. And as they come online, I think we have to revitalize a lot of the earlier conversations. I mean, another thing that's interesting to note, many of the people who had those conversations back in the 1970s are much older now. And there's a whole new generation, if not two generations, who have grown up within the sort of protection of the decisions that were made 30 years ago, and who should be everybody, but the folks doing the work especially should be encouraged to learn about that, so that we can have intelligent conversations about it. I think it's gonna hit people a lot faster than folks expect.
Can I ask you what it is that just to step back? What it is that you're building now? And I mean, are you not building people yet? Are you?
No, not even close.
Okay.
So let me give you.
You kind of raised this issue, but I mean, are we building feet, livers, toenails? What are we building right now?
Or E. coli, perhaps.
You know. Or anything.
Two things to say. So I myself don't build anything conveniently, right? So I'm a person who works on the framework, right? The languages and grammars that let other people build stuff. So
you're writing the programming language.
That's before, right. Yeah. So if it's Perl, you're interested in, I'm the Larry Wall equivalent.
Got it. Is there a name? I mean, is this like a language? I mean, do you call it something?
There's not a name for it, but there will be at some
point.
It's
called Life.
Yeah, I don't know.
Life Construction Kit, I think. The life. LCK.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is it like a language? I mean, I know we're making an analogy but is it really kind of
It's not
similar?
Formalized yet at that level, right? I mean, if you look at like the invention of Scheme, right? You know, or Lisp or whatever,
right
as a formal computer language, people were at that point in time able to write a very crisp document which summarized point of the language, its framing, and what have you. We're really at a much earlier ad hoc stage where we're just collecting the widgets. We don't even know what the set of basic functions is yet.
You're finding the parenthesis,
right? Right.
Because you don't even have primitives yet. You just
having said all that, right? I mean, the reason we're not just spewing hot air is that we're coupled to folks who are actually trying to build stuff, right? So, for example, this summer I had a team of five undergraduates working in my lab as part of this thing called iGEM. iGEM is the International Genetically Engineered Machine Competition.
Oh, right? Cool.
And so each summer, teams of students at schools all over the world spend their summer trying to design and build a genetically engineered machine of their choosing. Right. So whatever
now,
they
again,
want to do.
Again, is this on a computer screen? You're not.
No,
really,
no, no. This is physically
wetware here.
It's wetware,
it is.
Right? It's wetware. It's not. It's
wow.
It's, yeah. So for example, right, at MIT we had five students on the team. Three of them were freshmen or first years, and two of them were sophomores. Right. So they have little prior training, and they decided that they didn't like the odor of E. coli, you know, a little bacteria. They thought it smelled pretty bad.
So they wanted to make stinkless E. coli.
Well, they thought about that, but they decided they wanted to do a little bit better. They wanted to make E. coli that smelled like bananas. And so they looked at the metabolism inside the cell, the process by which one chemical is converted to another. and they found the chemical that causes E. coli to stink. And they said,
well, replace it with banana ester.
Well, basically, with isoamyl acetate.
Wow.
And they got another smell produced inside the cell. It's a chemical called methyl salicylate, which is wintergreen or mint. And so they now
the trick
have,
is to do this without destroying the E. coli.
Yeah, yeah, that's important. And, you know, without causing harm to anything, for that matter.
Right, right.
So
that's, I imagine that's quite a challenge because, as you pointed out at the very beginning, these are systems. You can't just unplug the E. coli smell and plug in something else.
Right, so that's a good question. So you would
Actually, maybe.
you would think it is a challenge. And I mean, and, you know, see, there's a field of engineering called, you know, metabolic engineering where people are trying to do this. And it's a you know, well-established field of engineering. And a project like this, you know, a couple years ago would have been, well, you know, could we do that? Maybe it'll take, you know, 10 people working for 5 years to do this, you know, postdocs and professors and graduate students. But as it turns out, we have five first and second year undergrads who are able to do this in a period of 10 weeks and succeed.
Unbelievable.
And so the question is, how come? Right?
Yeah.
And the question, the answer is, well, because they had access to some tools, some new engineering tools that make the process of doing the work easier and more reliable. They had access to a registry of standard biological parts where they could get hundreds of parts from to pick and choose and see if there were any that they could use. They had access to a framework, a set of standards for putting parts together so that they didn't have to debug all of the construction experiments. They just sort of work. And they don't have to be experts in it. Like, imagine if you're putting Legos together, and every time you tried to put two pieces together, you're like, oh, that doesn't fit, or
I
need to do a control experiment to see if my Legos go together. you know, so just get rid of all of that. Make it more like engineering, right? Imagine, you know, another example would be you went to the hardware store and bought a nut and a bolt, and you didn't know whether they'd go together because the screw threads weren't uniform. And so we've...
E. coli is pretty well understood.
It's horribly incomplete in terms of its understanding. I mean, relative to other things from nature, it's very well understood. But in an absolute sense, it's more or less not understood at all.
Well, I guess that's the main challenge of synthetic biology is not to understand it entirely, but to control it.
Yeah, and a number of projects are underway now to sort of replace E. coli with an engineered surrogate that's wholly optimized to be easier to understand. Right.
That seems so. That sounds like that kind of thing is not so far off.
Well, we did so. For example, 2-3 years ago, we took the genome of a virus that infects E. coli, and we redesigned it to make it easier to understand. Right. So we've already demonstrated that it's possible to take a genome from a natural biological system and go through this process called refactoring, which, if you're familiar with computer programming, you've probably experienced, where you've got a bit of legacy. It works, but you like what it does, so you're going to rebuild it from the ground up. It still does the same thing, but it's organized better on the inside. So we've already done that and shown that it works. It hasn't yet been done for a full bacteria, but folks are working on that now. And people are also working on the technology. We talked briefly about synthesizing genes. The next thing you want to synthesize longer pieces of DNA are called genomes, the whole genetic complement of an organism. So folks are working on technologies for making the synthesis of genomes from scratch very straightforward. And, you know, as that happens, you'll see completely redesigned genomes.
One example that I've seen in the you present at I can't remember which lecture it was. Many of them are available online, and I'll put links up at the on our site if you don't mind.
Yeah, yeah.
Is the E. coli CCD.
Yeah, the
E. coli digital camera.
Yeah, the bacteria programmed to act as photographic film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Could you tell us a little bit about that? Because it's fascinating. It's just remarkable.
Well, so that was a project that was motivated by one of the teams working in the iGEM competition back in 2004. It was a team of students down in Austin, Texas. Jeff Tabor and colleagues down there. And one of the people they had working on their team was a fellow named Zach Booth Simpson, who is a computer programmer from the video game industry, who just sort of hangs out in the biochemistry department now down at UT. I think he had worked on the Wing Commander video game series, if anybody remembers that.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And he's a great, great programmer and artist. So anyway, he was looking at bacteria and go, wow, these things pretty much suck from the standpoint of computing. They're not very good computers, but we have lots of them. And so maybe we could get bacteria to do a little bit of computing for us and take advantage of the fact that there's lots of them. And the idea was to use light to program the bacteria to do something. And I guess Texas Instruments, you know, if you have the digital projectors that are based on the technology developed in
DLC.
The array of mirrors that toggle back and forth. Right. So the idea would be you could use the toggleable mirror array to program a surface of bacteria to start doing stuff, doing little dances on the surface and making things for you. and so the idea was, well, we're going to take bacteria, we're going to program them so they're responsive to light, and then we're going to, when they respond to light, we're going to have them do something like take a picture and then do edge detection on the picture they just took. And so what the team in Texas needed to do was convince, you know, again, this little bacteria called E. coli that it should pay attention to light, which it normally doesn't, right? E. coli lives inside your stomach and your gut really. So it doesn't see light normally, so it doesn't respond to light. So they
where the sun doesn't
shine. Yeah, right, exactly. Right. So now we know where that saying comes from. Right. So they collaborated with some folks out at San Francisco, Chris Voigt's group, who had found a protein from an organism, a bacteria that lives in the ocean, that sees light all the time, and needs to regulate its behavior when the sun's up or the sun's down. And so they grabbed this part, they re-engineered it, Anselm Lascaius, the guy who did all the work, and they were able to move this part into E. coli so that now E. coli had a little primitive eye, you know, could detect light. And as soon as you can get E. coli to detect light, then you can hook it up to all a bunch of other things to get them to do stuff. And next thing you know, you have a team of students and Zach, the, you know, rogue computer programmer, who have made E. coli act as a, you know, living photographic film. So there you have it, right? Why not? I wouldn't have. What was cool about it for me is, you know, again, as somebody who's sort of working at a more abstract level, thinking about the framework by which this work is done, I would have never dreamt up, you know, an idea of programming E. coli to act as photographic film. But as soon as you see it happen, you're like, oh, yeah, that's really cool. You know, maybe I could use this to start to make materials on surfaces, you know, program the bacteria with light, then have the bacteria make little proteins and whatnot that fold up into very precise, you know, structures that help us, you know, if they don't become the computers of the future, they'll help us make the computers, that sort of thing. So I don't know, you know, if you give people a programming language, then people will start writing programs and hopefully imagined and want to make cool programs or useful programs, and good things happen.
What's the interface between the software and the wetware? Is there some magical vat?
It's the DNA synthesizer, right?
So it's that synthesis stuff that we've been doing all along.
Yeah, it's the synthesizer is this machine. You can think of it as a black. It's like a laser printer, right? You have an inkjet printer, right? What is an inkjet printer? It takes toner cartridges and paper, and then it just waits for information to come in from somewhere, and then it prints something out.
It does what a chemist was doing maybe 25 or 30 years ago, linking up each base of DNA one at a time, but can do so on a large scale.
Yeah, I mean, Gobind Khurana's lab is you know, one floor above mine here, and his lab spent about 100 person years making a piece of genetic material that was 100 letters long, right? So that's one person year per letter, and it was a heroic amount of work, right?
Wow.
The guy's got the Nobel Prize, right? That was done 30 years ago. Today, you have a black box, which is fully automated, which can make millions of DNA at the same time, right? For dimes a base, basically, you know. So imagine a future where you have your inkjet printer on your desktop, and that prints out paper, and then you have this new type of printer called a stinkjet, right, which prints DNA, right, 12 million base pairs of DNA per minute, double stranded, right, and so that is the interface between the software and the wetware.
I'd like to ask you one last question. Could you tell us a little bit about BioBricks, the BioBricks Foundation?
So BioBricks is an idea that was invented by a colleague of mine here at MIT named Tom Knight. Tom is an engineer True and true. And he's the reason I moved to MIT to learn more engineering. So Tom came up with this idea of biobricks. And the biobricks are the standard biological parts, the objects themselves. And what makes a biobrick different than a random piece of DNA that might do something is that a biobrick exists within this framework that makes the putting together of the pieces of DNA very simple, so that our first-year undergraduates can do it without being experts in genetic engineering. You know, I mean, so how does biotech work right now, or how does biology work right now, right? Everybody has their favorite part. And when you have your favorite part, you love it very much. And you love it in many different ways. You want to work, you want to become famous, you want to get the Nobel Prize, you want to make lots of money by selling your part. And so what happens is, that's fine, and it gets people really excited and motivates all the work. But now along comes synthetic biology, right? And we're in the business of programming in DNA. And we want to put together lots of parts over and over and over again in novel combinations to make many, many different programs. And so we need to have a collection of thousands of parts, if not more, that we can have basically unfettered access to. We can't afford to have to go to you or talk to anybody else in order to get access to and use these things. We just have to be able to use them. And so, unfortunately, from our perspective, reality does not map well onto our needs. Thus, we need to promote the construction of this new collection of lovable objects. Right? So by analogy, right, you could imagine if you were a computer programmer, and every time you wrote a computer program, you had to go get permission to use the if-then statement from the guy who discovered if-then. And you had to go get permission for the print statement from the gal who invented print. That just wouldn't work.
It would take forever to accomplish anything.
That's right. You would spend all of your life trying to get, you know, 20 different agreements negotiated, and you'd give up before you even started. And if you look, there are many examples of that sort of pitfall creeping into biotech. Folks aren't able to integrate many different technologies without a heroic amount of work. A great example of this would be the Golden Rice project, where people were trying to engineer rice. I don't remember the exact numbers, but dozens, if not hundreds, of licenses had to be negotiated in order to put that together. So the purpose of the BioBricks Foundation is to sort of, one, put a stake in the cultural landscape that says, hey, we need to do better than this. We need to pull off this hack of beginning the accretion, of this collection of low-level objects that everybody can have access to, that are free to use, that everybody can improve, so that we can all go on to the more important work of making useful objects, pulling the integrated systems together and getting them to work. Right? So you can imagine if the team that was making the photographic film out of bacteria, or changing the odor of E. coli from one thing to bananas, spent 10 weeks with the technology licensing offices, you know, clearing all of these legal hurdles before they could even start doing something in the lab. It kills the work before it even gets started. So the purpose of the foundation, the BioBricks Foundation, the BBF, is to take that problem off the table and really let everybody, you know, contribute and compete, if that's what you want to do, up at the more valuable levels of functioning systems that do important things.
It seems really important that if you're going to engineer, if life is going to be, you know, if you're going to...
substrate for engineering.
Yeah, substrate for engineering. You need to have open source, a consortium that sort of allows you to
I think public acceptance of the technology should require that as well. You know, I don't know that I trust myself not to make a mistake. I don't trust other people to not make mistakes. I'd like to, you know, if I'm going to live in a future where there are mission-critical biological technologies that are engineered by society depend on, it better be the case that I can take a look at them. You know, I don't want the equivalent of the operating system for wheat in the year 2050 to be running some, you know, horrendous closed code that crashes all the time and I have no idea what's going on. That just seems like an untenable future.
Well, this is extremely forward-looking. I think you've obviously got a lot of hope and you're inspired, I suppose is a good word, and really looking at the next 100 years, not just the next 5 years. And I think that's what why I was very excited to have you on the show as a guest for Futures in Biotech, because it's really not what went on 10 years ago, but really what's going to go on for the next 100 years. Or maybe shorter, as you say.
Yeah, I think it's. I think what's important to recognize is it's actually already working,
right?
And it's been working over the last. You know, it's been something that's been underway for 10 years. It started to work about 5 years ago, and it's now at the point where first college undergraduates are having success in biological engineering because we've made it easier. We have a lot more work to do, and it's not the case that we're. You know, constructing human beings from scratch, nor are we intending to anytime soon. But it's also not too early to take the issues around such questions and, you know, seriously.
Well, I could certainly see the value of having a mouse that has been completely broken down into parts and rebuilt so that we could use it in the lab for, you know, for drug discovery, for example, you know, or for other purposes. But I think it's exciting that you bring forward these sort of concepts because it really gives us a lot of interesting ideas that, you know, but it's very forward looking. So I think that's it's really cool.
As you say, it's a very science fiction and magical stuff. But what's amazing to me is how far we've come already and so far. And I have to agree with your statement earlier on at the very beginning that we're not so far off from a time when this is commonplace. And affordable.
If you go back 100 years, right, MIT does have another department of electrical engineering, right? And it just doesn't exist.
Right.
Right. And so now we're having this conversation using Skype and wireless networks and laptop computers and what have you, right? And it all exists in digital information, right? Which itself is a technology, you know, for communication that doesn't go back that far. So when people say that the 21st century is a century of biology, from a technology perspective, what is it actually going to mean? It means that when the year 2100 rolls around, well, we're going to have departments of biological engineering, which more or less don't exist today. People are going to have pulled off the equivalent of very large-scale integrated engineering for biologics in place of electronics. And we're going to have to become very comfortable with taking responsibility for the responsible development and deployment of the technologies. And to imagine otherwise, to imagine that you know, the manipulation of information as genetic material isn't as important to our society as our abilities today for implementing technologies for digital manipulation of information on computers. It's just you know, kind of naive.
I'd hate to say it, but the term playing God is really where synthetic biology could go. It's not an understatement to say that kind of thing. It depends if you're agnostic.
I have strong feelings about that. If you give me 30 seconds, I mean, when we look at the people who designed the microprocessors, you know, at Intel, do we think they're playing God? No, they're sort of designing and building and constructing something. And I think it is construction. And not to be pedantic, but if you think about what those words mean, creation is, gods create, right? They have unlimited power, perfect knowledge, and an ability to manipulate matter at whatever level they want. Well, so it's like, what happens when we make it really, really easy to engineer biological systems, right? Such that, you know, our ability to design and build living organisms is as good as our ability today to run computers or to design televisions or cars, will we be playing God at that point in time? And from my perspective, you know, I respect the comment and the question, but it misrepresents what engineering's about and what our capabilities imply, right? So a God is, you know, God has perfect knowledge, ability to manipulate the physical world however is needed, and unlimited resources, basically, right? Whereas engineers, human beings, imperfect understanding, a budget, finite resources, and very primitive means by which to manipulate the physical world.
But perhaps in 100 years, it's always,
but it's still always going to be the case that we have budgets, we don't have, you know, unlimited amounts of energy, for example. We're not going to have a perfect understanding of anything still. Science will still be going on. And, you know, nevertheless, we're still designing and building things, right? In the same way that we design and build buildings, even though we don't understand everything about the materials and gravity in the universe in which buildings exist and are quite useful. So from my perspective, gods get to create. And I know some people who wouldn't mind playing God, but let's be realistic, they don't have godlike powers. Engineers, on the other
hand. I guess you're not deciding between life and death. Unless you're
already engineers decide between life and death all the time. Buildings stay up or fall down. Planes fly or crash. The things engineers do are important. You know, they need to work reliably. They need to be responsibly developed and deployed. But it's an important distinction that engineers are in the construction business. You know, gods can be in the creation business. And I think if you consider what distinction is in the sort of capabilities and power of somebody who can only construct, then it's a lot more humbling, and we have to be a lot more careful, and we have to be realistic about what we can do and what we can't do. And so I think there's a sort of natural tendency to look at this technology and go, oh my God, these people are off running around trying to play God. But that misrepresents our actual capabilities and sort of biases the conversation in a way that's frantic as opposed to thoughtful. So something to think about at least.
Well, as somebody who spent a lot of time in working in molecular genetics, I emphasize with you completely. I was just sort of presenting the idea that people might think that, well, if you're generating an organism, a living organism, and doing it under, you know, controlled, using principles of engineering and approaches, they might extrapolate, you know, seeing that the technology could eventually lead to a point where
I mean, it's not to say that it isn't a big deal. It is a big deal, but it needs to be recognized as a technology that's developed and applied by human beings who are imperfect, and
under the rules
absolutely,
of law,
right? And so,
you know, there might have to be some kind of United Nations sort of council, somewhat like the Security Council controlling. In the United Nations Security Council regulating who's allowed to play around
right,
with
so,
nuclear weapons.
And it's important to note that there already exists such frameworks for doing anything with genetic engineering today, right, that are 30 years old and that have worked more or less quite reliably in that they've allowed for the constructive development and application of genetic engineering technology, mostly for good, for a lot of good. It's not perfect. It's done by human beings, but it's had a huge positive impact on the world so far. So we need to figure out how to continue to support those frameworks, to make them better, to improve them as needed, to fix them if they're broken, and to make sure that all of the, you know, people who are impacted by the technology are participating in the process by which it's governed, so that it's done in a way that leads to, you know, improvements not just to a couple people, but to everybody who stands to benefit from it.
Well, we're definitely at the dawn of a new era, right?
This is
extremely exciting.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun right now.
Yeah, well, I really thank you for coming on.
Sure, my pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity.
Well, thanks again, and have a good day.
Okay, you too.
Today's guest was Dr. Drew Andy, who's the Cabot Assistant Professor of Biological Engineering at MIT. I'd like to thank Harry Gill and Mark Parker for reviewing the show notes for today's netcast, and I'd like to thank the band Gunther for providing the song Wrecking Ball as the theme for Futures of Biotech. I'd like to also thank Philip Peltier for much of the equipment used to record today's show. And lastly, the disclaimer, the ideas and opinions expressed here do not reflect those of Yale University or the Yale School of Medicine. For Futures in Biotech, this is Mark Jackson.